Hello and welcome to Talk Gnosis. This is our spin-off show, The Black Iron Prison, where we talk to people who may not necessarily consider themselves Gnostics or not quote-unquote part of the Gnostic world, whatever that is. If you ask me, we're in a Gnostic world. But we're talking to artist Sterling Bartlett, and he released an awesome graphic novel, art book, comic. What do you call it, Sterling?
It's a comic.
Yeah, I actually kind of hate using the phrase graphic novel now because it's just like a pretentious way to like be like, I don't read comic books. Anyways, here it is. It's How Did We Get Here? For all those people at home, I am holding it up on the screen. You can get your own copy. Oh wait, I didn't do the banner yet, but hey, we'll do that plug in a moment. You know what? paying myself first in plugs. Hey, everybody, we can't do the show without your support. I hate begging for money, but I gotta do it. PayPal.com/Gnostic for one-time donations. You can go to Patreon.com/Gnostic where you can donate for as little as $1 per piece of media per month, and you get early access to the shows. We're going to put the credits back on. You'll get your name in the credits. We're always trying to give people stuff for signing up for the Patreon without actually locking up any content. We're doing more than this. So for instance, I'm not running this show through the Patreon. We only run, you know, 4 to 6 shows through the Patreon. The rest are kind of paid for by your generosity. So we actually are starting a bunch of different spin-off shows. This isn't the only one. You know, we're over on Twitch doing live streams of Cult. We're on Twitch doing Talking Gnosticism, which is a panel hangout show. We're always trying to do more stuff. So give us your money so we can do even more and so I don't starve to death. Sterling, I want to tell people at the top of the show, we'll also remind them at the back and to pick up the book and where to do it. So just give me one sec here to do the banner because this is important. You know, people, they zone out, they turn it off. Okay, get your copy of How Did We Get Here at firstinoc.com/products/How Did We Get Here. It's going to be in the show notes if you're listening to this as audio. So stop whatever you're doing, go buy it, and then come back and hit play and listen to the rest of this interview. Sterling, I did make some notes, not a proper question sheet. Some of my notes are one or two words, but how did we get here is a question the Gnostics were obsessed with. This is where they start all their mythology, right? And they thought it was very important to understand in a mythological sense or a religious sense, how did we get here? Because we can't get out without understanding how we got here. So tell us about your comic. How do we get here? Your inspiration for it. Why did you feel compelled to create it?
Sounds good. First, thanks for having me. Stoked to discuss the book and chat with you a little bit. How Did We Get Here is essentially a 10-part hellfire sermon, kind of being proselytized by a intergalactic entity named Void. He descends to Earth and proceeds to hopefully give us a little bit of a pep talk so we can graduate galactic kindergarten.
Perfect. And I think already some people, even if you didn't set out to create a religious text, right? We already have some religious language here with the sermon and with the visitor kind of coming to wake us up. And I did notice, right, we have at the beginning, the Void isn't the first messenger for you, right? We have angels, Bigfoot, we have cryptids, we have aliens, with the Void saying, I'm not the only messenger. Yes. Do you believe, and again, we don't have to talk about this in religious language, right? You know, there's Hegelian and the collective unconscious and lots of sort of different ways of thinking about this. But an inbreaking of something new, an inbreaking of a new way of living, or an inbreaking of an old way of living, it in breaking. Do you believe in something like that, Sterling?
Certainly, yeah. And actually, that's kind of a new mode of thinking for me as I sort of enter middle age. I you know, essentially grew up a center leftist person that was a rather humanist, and I definitely had a kind of change of I don't want to say a change of heart, like a change of mind. Just reading enough stories that pointed back to some sort of a creation myth or like a breaking in that definitely became a part of my consciousness a few years back. And that definitely informed writing this book.
Yeah. We get some feedback, almost never directly, almost every secondhand, which, by the way, I'm very approachable. If anybody ever wants to talk to me about anything on the show, I'll dialogue, right? So my email is down below. But reading the book, I was thinking some people are going to read this and be like, this flipping commie. And then I was reading it, and I was thinking some people are going to read it and be like, you know, this incel Chad alt-right monster. Can you talk a little bit about how there's something to piss off everybody in this book?
Yeah, I mean, I personally am staunchly nonpartisan as a general rule. And I wanted to have that come across in the book itself. There are jabs at subtle jabs, maybe oblique jabs at leftist politicians, at recycling, but at the same time, there is an overarching kind of pervasive, shall we say, like queasiness or mistrust of power structures, and again, kind of obliquely, that ensures that we're not coming from a far right position or a far left position. And I'm really itchy about the sort of centrist idea. It's not that either, because centrist would imply that you're kind of half in one camp and half in the other. And this is an entity that is coming at us from outside of our political structures, outside of our cultural structures, and critiquing them in a real top-down way. And that was the sort of impetus for me when I started writing this.
Yeah. And, you know, I kind of deliberately, as I said, people, I think, guess what my politics are sometimes when I do talk about, this is not meant to be a politics show, right? Sure. But to talk about Gnosticism, I have to talk about the world that we live in. So some people read that as political, and they guess my politics, but they always guess wrong, and you're never going to guess, and I'm never going to tell. So, but kind of staying with that theme for a moment, Sterling, like, for the ancient Gnostics, for the modern Gnostics, as I said, one thing they were obsessed with was how do we get here? But of course, they were obsessed with just that the world sucks and we have to wake up to the fact that the world sucks. But it seems to me that a lot of people have woken up to the fact that the world sucks, that there's major problems. But the right says it's because of Hollywood and cultural Marxism, you know, no prayer in schools. You know, the center says it's because of fake news and extremism on both the right and the left. Right. The cultural left says it's because of the racist cishet patriarchy and people aren't recycling enough. Yeah. So people know that things suck. And I always thought, and particularly, you know, being a child of the 90s, you know, before we started recording, you know, I grew up at the end of history. I graduated high school in 1999. People did not think that the world sucked, right? I mean, the goths at school did. But you know what I mean? It was the end of history, but there was a weird sort of optimism, right? This is it, right? We have it all figured out. Exactly. So is the first step figuring out that this sucks? And these narratives that I mentioned, both the right, the left, and the center, can any of these lead to freedom?
Well, there's a huge question there. Let me first address the beginning, which is, do these conversations matter? And the answer is yes. I wouldn't have spent a year and a half writing a book and hoping to get it published if I didn't think these conversations matter. More importantly, I think it's important to have a novel take and an interesting inroad into these conversations that is not particularly left, right, or center.
Yeah.
So addressing that, I'm not sure if I can really frame the second part of your question. However, I think we're at, you know, the end of history or the beginning of something new. That's a bit optimistic. I'm not sure. But this is the point where we get narratives together. This is the point in this beginning arc or the end of arc or whatever it is, where we really have to kind of like figure it out, get our ducks in a row, and then push forward.
Yeah. And I do really appreciate how both the book and just talking to you, how stepping outside of at least these political frames, right? Which is also kind of a cliche, right? But I often coming from centrists, that, you know, this thing I want to talk about, I don't want to talk about it in a political way. But at the same time, you know, this is what I'm trying to do with the show. This is what the religious communities I'm associated with are trying to do, right? Like we don't, you know, we want you to watch the show regardless of your beliefs. We want you, when I do religious stuff, to come, as long as you're respectful of other people's beliefs. But I wonder, and you know, I'm just spinning here, but how do we sort of kind of reach people and talk about these issues without the political lens and people immediately going to culture war political stuff, right? Because this is how we communicate. It's how we talk about important issues.
Well, first, there is no non-political. The personal is the political. The cultural is political. So it's just, it's just about reframing. So yes, we are talking about politics. I am talking about politics in almost every single one of these 10 entries in this book, 10 small chapters. However, the way we talk about it is through community. We talk about it, you know, finding that wherever that means outside that sphere, you know, drawing out a Y or a Z axis in this XY thing we've been sort of trapped in for so long. You know, you call the show the Black Iron Prison. That's a great example right there. But a reframing through the lens of community as well as humor, like Spoonful of Sugar is very real to me. Like I always go back to that. The bits of culture that really downloaded themselves in my mind when I was young that had an element of politics or an element of cultural critique in them were always humorous. Like immediately I think of Terry Gilliam, for example.
Yeah, and for those to encourage people to get the book, when I talk about it, it sounds like, you know, you're on meth on a box screaming at people, right? But it's not that. It's playful. It's fun. The humor comes through, right? So I think you have achieved that, and it's great that is obviously your goal. So just to get that across to people, Sterling, do you believe in transcendence? And if you do, have you ever experienced it?
That's tough. Capital C concept. Yes, I believe in transcendence. I am personally a very quotidian kind of day-to-day individual. If I've experienced transcendence, it's been through things like psychedelics or being in nature, lowercase t transcendence. I don't know that I've experienced it writ large. Do I believe in it? Certainly.
Yeah. You know, I actually wonder about, when you say writ large, like, you know, sometimes there's this idea of transcending and kind of staying there. And I suspect that the elements of transcendence or the experience of transcendence that you described is whatever this transcendence stuff is, right? And there's different ways of experiencing it and getting there because it's natural and human.
There's a lot of roads there. I had a conversation not too long ago about like heavy, like doses of like drug experiences and stuff. And, I was joking with the person, but I was serious and saying like, oh, I experienced ego death. And they're like, no, you didn't. You're here talking with me now. And, you know, whatever. And I was like, well, that shit grows back.
Yes. So. Yeah. Yeah. And I would like to, for a sec, riff on that too, which is for those who are watching who are spiritual practitioners, right? That Sterling has just delivered a very profound teaching there, or Sterling and your friend did, because this has been my experience both personally and sort of dealing with others who are doing a lot of work on themselves and doing stuff like meditation, and they feel like they've made some progress, but as you put it, that shit grows back.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about art as salvation on this show, and you and transcendence through art, and understanding Gnosticism as a kind of art, art as a kind of Gnosticism. These are recurring themes. It's something we talk a lot about on the Black Iron Prison, but as well as the mainstream show. And actually, if you look throughout history, you know, a lot of great artists were inspired specifically by Gnostic ideas. But so there's the transcendence through art, there's the Gnosticism of art, but what I want to ask you about is the art world, which I suspect, which I'm not a part of, which I suspect is very different from art, and perhaps may not have these transcendent elements and salvational functions. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, at the top, I'll just say I was a very peripheral spectator to the art world for about 20 years. Never been a major player, but I've seen behind the curtain enough to know how at least a little sliver of it works. Essentially, the art world is a, you know, and I discussed this in the book, but it's an economy fueled by a sole commodity, commodity being art, of course. If you think of it more like a stock or a commodity that's openly traded on a marketplace, you have a much better idea of what the art world is than if you went into it with ideas of transcendence or ideas of art school as pipeline to a certain kind of high-minded idealism.
Yeah. And of course, I am sort of asking specific questions about some of the chapters in the book, right? But everybody, as I said, it's dealt with in very interesting ways. So don't think you're getting a download of what's in the actual book. But you have a chapter on boredom and the abolition of boredom. Sure. And you know, I found that really fascinating because one, I'm someone who's always hated quote unquote being bored. You know, I grew up in a small town in the 80s and 90s. So I was acquainted with boredom in a way that people my age now, or sorry, you know, teenagers now would have no conception of.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about, like, and I am addicted to my phone. I like not being bored. But can you talk a little bit about, you know, why this may not be the best thing in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken about this a few times in discussing the book. There is a chapter called The Abolition of Boredom, and it's essentially two people in an office space, one being a man, the other being a woman who's kind of vaguely interested in him. And he has no clue because he's in his phone and, you know, he doesn't know that she's flirting with him successively over the course of a work day. I want to mention something that I've noticed. You mentioned that you, growing up in the 80s and 90s, had a certain conception of boredom, and you now run a podcast in which you try to discuss high-minded topics with a disparate number of people. That's a generative approach to boredom. Yeah. When you say, like, a younger person now that, you know, digital natives born and raised on the internet may not experience, I think there's been a shift between a generative type of boredom, harnessing your boredom and writing it into a project. For me, that was drawing endlessly. You know, I would just begin to doodle and that, you know, became a career for me. But, and for you, it's the podcast and a number of other endeavors, I'm sure. I wonder if harnessing and wrenching boredom into generative prospects is as widely received as I think it was in the time that we grew up. And I don't want to get trapped in like a nostalgia reality tube. That's not generative or helpful either. But it's a question that always comes back to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, just to make sure that it's not too boring old farts talking about the old days, right? This is it doesn't seem like the world's going downhill. But let's hop in the time machine and go back literally 20 years ago to the release of the premiere album by The Strokes. Because I remember, you know, living in, you know, a dumpy house of five other people while going to college, right? And so I'm bringing it over and being like, you got to listen to this. This is the best thing I've ever heard, right? So can you talk a little bit about The Strokes and viewing, I think some people might find this humorous, but kind of the Gnostics were obsessed with sort of the falseness of reality, of deception, mm-hmm. of being trapped in illusion. So can you talk about the Strokes and with some of these themes?
I mean, absolutely. You brought up in just casually Fukuyama's The End of History, right?
Yeah.
And to me, the Strokes are the emblem. They are the band. They are they're Sergeant Peppers of the end of history.
Yeah.
They were packaged and sort of advertised as a new savior for rock and roll, when in fact they were a garage rock band in the tradition of a million other garage rock bands that were an amalgam of Tom Petty and the Ramones and the Replacements, and in equal parts, and all of their reference from their logo, which was the Magna cigarette brand, all their clothes look like Lou Reed. When in reality, while they were packaged as this new thing, there couldn't be anything less new. It was like the full force of the history of rock and roll had been distilled and put into little bottles, and we were all just chugging it. And it, at the time, I was absolutely enamored of like the what they ended up calling like the garage rock revolution or revival or whatever it was. In retrospect, it was just simply nothing new.
Yeah, exactly. No, I remember liking a lot of bands from that movement. And of course, this sounds like, you know, I'm trying for 20-year-old cool points, right? But I remember when they did bring that album over, I was like, this shit sucks. Like, I have Television on vinyl. We can put that on right now.
Sure, right.
Yeah. although there is a lot of, I was very, very influenced and did really like the garage rock revival at the time. Have you read the most embarrassing book ever written is Meet Me in the Bathroom. Have you ever read that?
No, I know of it. I haven't read.
If you're looking for a hate read, my friend, I mean, I hate read slash like it's. I hate to be a 40-year-old man using this word that is already what it portrays, but it's cringe, all capital letters, right? Yeah. Like you may weep from embarrassment for the writer. So if you want to do that to yourself, read that book. Urban Daredevils. Again, when we're kind of to go back to being old parts, maybe there's some Zoomers watching this who are like, what are they talking about? But can you just? I don't really have a deeper question than that. That's the question. Urban Daredevils? Question mark.
Yeah. So again, there are like 10 small chapters where this entity comes and sort of gives us these little cues as to, you know, some cultural or political or societal reasons of. Why we are in our current kind of dystopian present. One is just a one-page single image, and it says Urban Daredevils. Now, Urban Daredevils is a oblique reference to a portion in the Kentucky Fried movie, which is very different from what I'm describing, but that is where the title comes from. In this book, the picture are two young people shot from above, holding an iPhone extension handle, whatever they're called, selfie stick, from the very top of the tallest building in the tallest city. And Void is pictured kind of, you know, with his hand out describing the image and says something to the effect of, do you remember living in a time in which everything was so hermetically safe that you actually had to engineer your own demise. You had to engineer the threat to your own mortality. And this stems from me seeing, I don't know, tens, hundreds of TikTok and Instagram videos of these like weird kids that would just climb to the top of buildings, and some were base jumpers and others would just get their kicks by like doing push-ups on the top of a crazy building. It's nauseating to look at, makes you terrified. But it was pervasive enough that I thought that it had to have some larger societal implication. And with the onset of the pandemic or whatever, that was one of the last ones I drew. And it was just a real notion that something had really changed in our perception of safety and our perception of like compliance to certain rules.
Yeah, yeah. So I was talking a bit about, you know, you have that great intro bit with the with the messengers of the inbreaking, right? Angels, cryptids, and the void is our messenger now. But unlike and this is also a very Gnostic idea. The Gnostics were some of the first to look at different world religions and say, you know, actually that prophet or that leader from your religion is a Gnostic prophet, right? Like there's continuously coming from the source messengers, right? Yes. And of course also not just in that specific case, you know, those were in many cases literal human beings, but they would also say, you know, that God or that angel that you talk to in your dream, right? So why is the void the inbreaking messenger in your book as opposed to another messenger? And why does the book end with a threat, right? Because the void says, you know, I've come, I've given you the message, but if you don't receive it, then you know I'm going to be back.
Yes. Well, there, without spoiling anything, there is a rather severe kind of, call it an Easter egg or a Rosetta Stone, and in the interior final page of the book, that points to Void's not only Gnostic origins, but bureaucratic origins. And there is a subtle nod to the fact that, at least in the cosmology of this comic, there may be a structure to this universe that is both, shall we say, religious, but also like very flat and quotidian. Without spoiling, I'm speaking kind of obliquely here, but like,
please.
without spoiling, that interior final page actually gives you the answer to the first part of your question. Second, the threat is implied therein as well. However, not being a majorly religious person myself, there is always a little bit of a taunt or a challenge that that comes from these figures that are delivered to us from upon high. And I wanted to fold that into a lot of what I was talking about in the book. That challenge kind of references the military industrial complex a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it challenges our notion of what it means to have conflict on Earth.
Yeah, I really like that. And again, kind of tying it into Gnostic themes, a lot of people read the Gnostic mythology, which says that this world is a prison, right? And there's basically a celestial hierarchy that is doing its best to keep us there. And they read it as pure evil, right? They take these figures and see them as demonic. Where I think, for at least an interesting reading, a valid reading, a reading that might have been on the minds of the people who originally created this mythology, is they were dealing with the Roman Empire and with, at that point, the incredible bureaucracy of the Roman Empire. Yeah. And I would argue that what they're portraying is not necessarily evil entities, but a sort of cosmic bureaucracy, right? That has different values than we do.
Yeah. I often have this idea that, like, you know, turtles all the way down, sure, but also maybe bureaucracy all the way up.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say, it's spooky month when we're recording this. I've been trying to think of horror movies and content with Gnostic themes. And I don't think I can do a whole show on Beetlejuice, but their portrayal of the afterlife as this horrible bureaucracy,
Another movie that comes to mind with that theme is Defending Your Life, with Albert Brooks.
Oh, I haven't seen it. Oh, I like Brooks. Yeah.
You're welcome. It is specifically about the litigious and bureaucratic world you enter after this one, and you must literally defend your life in court.
Yeah,
incredible.
Wow. Yeah, I'll probably watch it tonight.
Awesome. I recommend it. Rip Torn, it's great.
Fantastic. And sorry, I don't mean to go through all 10 chapters and say explain it, but so you have the chapter on influencers, and there, I think a lot of people even now would say, aren't a lot of these a good thing, because you know, you have these girl boss influencers, right, who are telling women to get empowered. You have these Sigma male influencers who are telling men to live up to your dreams. So aren't these influencers trying to get us to reach our highest potential? Isn't this a positive thing in our culture?
The impulse to influence, I mean, in the book, I call them disruptors, because that's the, you know, sort of branded ideology we all have at this point, you know, the TED Talk industrial complex, et cetera. But the impulse to influence is positive. It's just the why behind it that I'm critical of. You know, there are, in one example I use, like Suze Orman, whatever her name is, and you know, I say something like, she told you to get rid of your coffee every morning and instead invest the money in a Roth IRA. Yeah. And like, that betrays a distance between that person and the average working person who's just trying to get through a day. You're going to take that person's coffee away from them now? Like, I don't know if that's really productive. I talk about the guy who made the Soylent drink, and I get into, only in a world where you know, work has overtaken so much of our lives, are there any need for these tips or tricks? Like, oh, you have to drink your food because you work 20 hours a day and sleep 3. Like, that's not a good thing. These are patches for a sick culture. They're not ways to get ahead, really.
Just like when you were talking about the final page, right, and that you don't want to give away, quote unquote, all the secrets, no. Right? Like, we want people to approach it as a piece of art. So you don't have to answer these questions. But again, if you could talk about them or talk about why you ended the book with them. But you end the book with 3 important questions. Yeah. Should we accelerate or hit the brakes? Yeah. Am I really helping or just play acting? And of course, how do we get here? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the first is a nod to accelerationist theory from Nick Land, a little bit of Mark Fisher, the CCRU. It's questioning, is that appropriate? And is that a generative, positive move? Or is that a way to just make everything worse? And have we already been doing that? Are we helping or are we just play acting? Now, this is where I do have some political allegiance, because at least in the negative sense, I see nothing but programmatic infographics lobbed at one another, you know, just copy pasted, not even generated by the people that post these things. Are you helping when you do that? When you are using someone else's words to chide and cajole your peers into thinking exactly the way you think? Is that helpful or is that punitive? So that's what I mean when I ask, are we helping or are we just play acting? When we, you know, I'm critical of a number of things. Like, I'm critical of the idea that, like, of protest at this point even. Is that a way to let the higher ups know that you are unhappy with your day-to-day life, or is it just a way to post on Instagram that you were at X event or Y event? It sounds a little cynical. This isn't to say I haven't protested things in the past. I've just become fatigued with a kind of a pervasive narrative that does not seem to have gotten us anywhere.
Yeah. You probably already know this, or probably all the listeners already know this, but it's obvious, but I'm not that smart. I wear glasses and use big words, so for 40 years, people have thought I'm smart. But a protest is called a demonstration, right? And it was originally called a demonstration because it was a demonstration of the amount of people you could put out in the streets as a threat. Right. We will strike. We will shut down the streets. Yeah. You know, next time, like, we're showing you what we can do. We can grind society to a halt. Unless you make changes, we're going to do that. But that doesn't seem to be the point of so-called demonstrations anymore, right?
No, I don't think so. I think in certain cases, It's the inverse of that. It's a lateral demonstration, not a demonstration from the bottom up.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the reception to the book been?
Largely positive. We are moving quite a few of them. We still have a few left of the publishers. If, you know, in a perfect world, I'd love to sell this thing out before the end of the year. And it looks like we may be close to on track to doing that. You know, fingers crossed, we'll see. I've definitely gotten some pushback. Even you mentioned in the very beginning, like, this may seem like a bit programmatic, or a bit kind of like it's coming from like an all-knowing author. That's been a criticism. But those are also the people who didn't pick up on the humor in the book. So
yeah.
Who knows?
Exactly. I guess I could see that criticism, but it's a dumb criticism, because I think when combined with the humor and the points of the book, then, you know, a slightly more sophisticated reader should be able to pick that up.
I mean, at the end of the day, it's a comic book. Comic books went one of two ways growing up for me. They were either like high adventure and kind of like tinged with soap opera elements, or they were very funny. And I tried to grab a little bit of both.
Yeah. So I mentioned before I'm recording, this is a double Black Iron prison day for me, because I had the afternoon off. So I'm interviewing Kristen Middleton from Aeona Comics next. I'm going to throw that up on the screen. That's aeonacomics.bigcartel.com. You have a piece in there, the issue that just came out. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Aeonic Comics issue number 2. I have a short story in it, basically kind of dedicated to my dog. shout out to Clever. It's called Wishbone Broken, and it's essentially a story of what would happen if the beloved character Wishbone from Saturday morning television were to lose his marbles a little bit, and maybe there are some alien elements involved, and maybe he has had a certain part of his anatomy removed that a lot of young male dogs experience, and it's from his point of view and how that would affect a dog.
Yeah. Are you working on anything presently, and anything coming out that people should be looking forward to?
I am working on a very long form comic, I mean, graphic novel length, at least probably about 80, 100 pages. Yeah. I am just wrapping up the writing stage at this point, and I'm talking to a publisher about it. Very early days. All I can really say about it is it's essentially about a pop culture figure that we all know and all dearly love, and very, very prominent over the last 20 years, that I am positing, possibly in a vaguely nonfiction way, has a lot of intelligence ties, and what that means and how that played out over the last 20 years.
Ah, very intriguing. Well, I'm going to buy it, read it, and if I could shoehorn narcissism into it somehow, we're definitely going to have you back on the show to talk about it. Sterling, I've all out of questions, but I don't want to talk to you any more about the book, because, again, I just want people to read it, right? So, can you tell people where to get it again one more time?
Yeah, absolutely. The book is available at firsttoknock.com. It's my publisher. It is $7.50, and we also have a very, very limited number of hand-drawn covers available. So if someone wants a, you know, super snazzy deluxe edition, there are still a couple of those left.
Fantastic. Sterling, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. Bye.
See ya.